Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored. One of them co-authored with my daughter, The Finality of Jesus Christ. It's a very important book, and if anybody will let the scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mention those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of the book of Acts. We now come to Acts chapter 17, verse 16 and following. Paul is visiting Athens while he awaits the arrival of Timothy and Silas. But he cannot be silent. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit being provoked within him as he was beholding the city full of idols, deeply paganized. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and with the God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, "What would this idle babbler wish to say?" Others, "He seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities." That was because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection, a message totally unfamiliar to them. And they took him and they brought him to the Areopagus. In the process, they were saying, "We just want to know what this teaching is, which you are proclaiming. Like to hear more from you about it, for you're bringing some strange things to our ears, and we want to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now, all the Athenians and strangers visiting them used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. Let's go back to verse 16. We see that while Paul was waiting for Silas and Timothy in Athens, his spirit was being provoked. The imperfect tense of the verb in Greek indicates an ongoing convulsion of spirit. From this Greek verb, we get our English word paroxysm. It means a spasm, a fit, an outburst, or a convulsion. The point is that the sight of these pervasive images and altars to imaginary deities just fried the apostle. The idea of the worship of the true and the living God being perverted and diverted to lies projected onto these material images just convulsed him. What seized him was the outrageousness of false religion, wherein human beings, in their state of darkness, to quote Romans 1:21-23, did not honor God as God or give thanks to God, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, and boy did the Athenians, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Well, Paul could not stand down. He could not be detached. He could not simply be content to be a tourist or a cultural spectator and shrug his shoulders and say, boy, is that different? I think we can all relate to that. More and more we see outrages in our country. Maybe we do not see material idols sitting around on every corner, that kind of thing, but we see other forms of grossness and perversity that are so far off the charts of anything that is godly that we can really relate to the statement that Paul's spirit was provoked within him. Many would look at that stuff that Paul was looking at and say, my, my, what art. Others may have looked at it and said, boy, how religious are these Athenians? And they're so sincere. How can we say Christ is the only way? God will justify them too by their sincerity. That was not Paul's view of things. The more he looked at it, the more he saw the ignorance of it, the worse he saw the blasphemy of it. He could no longer stroll the marketplace and contain himself. Paul was jealous of God's honor as well as concerned for their souls. So finally, he just had to speak out, and he proceeded to do so everywhere he could find an opening. I marvel at his passion and his consistent sense of mission wherever the man was. You know, folks, listen, we should treat all human beings with respect. We should tolerate their religious choices. That is, we should accord them the right to make those choices, however wrong we know they may be. But at the same time, we believers should accept responsibility and always reserve the right as God gives us openings. I didn't say break down doors and crash in windows. But as God gives us openings, we should point men and women away from their errors and point them to Christ, respectfully, but nevertheless responsibly. As usual, however, he looked up a local synagogue when he got to Athens. He started his preaching with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. But his fervor has now carried him to that venue where all public dialogue about religion, philosophy, and politics was carried on in the city of Athens. The marketplace, which was not only the center of commerce, was also the seat of government and the site of intellectual forums as well, religious forums. So he ventured out there and he engaged those who happened to be present. This was not anything uncommon, but it was par for the course in the city of Athens. With Bruce, we note also that though Athens was not exactly a scheduled stop on his evangelistic tour, there's a model for us there. You see, the Apostle Paul was a man never far from his mission. He was never one to take a complete holiday from his work. In other words, he was always on duty. If he were living in our day, Paul, I feel certain, would not look fondly on our American love affair with leisure, and I include Christians in that. This man was always on call for the Spirit of God, and as the Holy Spirit opened doors, the apostle was ever ready for action, and he was never more so than when his spirit was provoked at the overwhelming sight of pagan worship and all the immoralities that everywhere attended it. By the way, just to show you how stubborn is cultural bad seed. How stubborn immorality so deeply ingrained in Athens 2,000 years ago remains. I got a taste of that on a trip over there 10 or 12 years ago. When I was last there, pornography, posing as art, I found in your face to such a degree that I've never personally encountered in any other marketplace I've ever visited. On that trip to Athens in this very Agora, the ancient one now restored and teeming today with tourists, Ossie and I, my wife, still talk to this day about how we could hardly go into any shop where we did not encounter figurines and other articles of so-called Greek art depicting scenes of gross sexuality. We both got the impression that the Athenians, I mean modern Athenians, were obsessed with sex, and I think they were. It seems to have become virtually genetic. And I don't think I've ever been in a place in the world, and I'm not a world traveler, but we've been around a little bit, but of the places that we have been, I don't think I've ever been in a city anywhere where people seem so generally unhappy. It was very uncommon to see a smiling face. In fact, I don't even remember one, but I've probably forgotten something. Well, in this context, Paul was jealous for God. He saw his glory defamed by these images, and he could not contain himself. Paul's reaction here raises to view a very contemporary issue in this pluralistic society, where all kinds of religious streams flow together along with Christianity. What does religious tolerance really mean? Well, as I said, we should, of course, treat all human beings with respect. But religious tolerance does not mean resigning our license to call a spade. It does not deprive us of our responsibility to call religious ignorance what it is and to warn its practitioners of judgment to come. Let's say a son or daughter chooses to go after the world and to live on the dark side morally and even religiously. Religious tolerance does not mean approving or condoning errant choices of others, nor does it mean simply renouncing attempts to persuade people otherwise. It only means that failing to do so, we freely grant them, even as God does, the right to be wrong and to bear the consequences of their tragic decisions. Today, in academic and in the temples of political correctness, tolerance, the word, is simply a code word for indulgence. It generally means accepting uncritically the moral choices and the religious points of view of others. Of course, this spirit of tolerance that these left-wing folks espouse applies only to those who approve the things they approve. We all know that. You will note that this generosity in many instances does not extend equally to the moral convictions and the religious viewpoints of biblical Christians. Take, for example, the pro-life stance. Take the idea of intelligent design. But, well, there's no tolerance for that whatever, is there? They won't let it near a public school. They would force us, in fact, if they could, to yield our convictions about homosexuality and so-called same-sex marriages. If they could muster even enough votes to make expressions of our views illegal, they would. I think, for example, the late Molly Irvins, a columnist for the Fort Worth paper, whose syndicated column was carried by the Oregonian. That's exactly what she wanted to do. And if my memory serves, in Canada and in France, you cannot speak a bad word about Islam. It's called hate speech. But the same protection does not apply to Christianity. You dare say, in those countries, nothing disrespectful of Muhammad, but you can disparage and blaspheme Christ all day. This instance of tolerance in this form is just an intolerant social intimidation tactic to silence those with viewpoints they oppose and to give license and encouragement to those that we take issue with. It's not the kind of tolerance that the Apostle Paul had in view. Respectful, yes, as we will see, but responsible to call error into question. So here we bring our application back to Paul and his negative reaction to idolatry in Athens. Folks, we must never place our regard for the feelings of others ahead of our feelings for God, and we should never allow our cultural sensitivity to take precedence over our respect for God's sensitivity to whatever dishonors and disparages him. A glaring example of this surrender to the sensitivities of man versus the sensitivity toward God was aired some time ago in a TV commentary in the wake of the Pope's visit. Two different people in our care group at our church heard on one channel a Catholic priest who was serving as a kind of color commentator, praising the Pope and his good manners, noting that in some venue or other, the Pope never once mentioned Jesus Christ. He was proud of that. To him, that was a grace note. Well, to the Apostle Paul, that would not have been a grace note, I'm certain. It would have been a disgrace. And it should be to us likewise. It is far better to be socially gauche in the sight of the cultural police than to strike our Christ colors in the sight of heaven. It is not that we are obliged to jump in everybody's face, don't get me wrong. But it is not that we should feel obliged to sit back and say nothing when people are in God's face with their outrageousness. There is a way to rebuke blasphemers without getting hateful and nasty, but also putting them on notice that their views and their actions are neither endorsed nor embraced by all. So unwilling to shrug off all this brazen idolatry, of which the Athenians were so proud, Paul set about setting the record straight in Athens. But I would remind you that his starting place was typical for him. He started his preaching there with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. But as he got out in the city, his fervor carried him to that venue where all public dialogue about religion, philosophy, and politics was carried on. The Agora, as it was called, was not only their city mall, but it was also, like Washington, D.C., the seat of government, the site of intellectual forums as well. And he just ventured out and began to engage those who happened to be present. If Rome was the political capital of the Greco-Roman world, Athens remained its intellectual, artistic, and even religious capital, inasmuch as it was regarded as the authentic custodian of the Greco-Roman gods and their mythological history. Rome was Washington, D.C. Athens was New York City in that world. Once more, I call your attention to his method. He was reasoning, which was either formally or functionally dialogical or both. Just as the Christian message is historically grounded, not mystically or mythically rooted, so our method of propagating our message should be rational, sensible, and thoughtful, aimed at the mind of men, not sentimental and emotional. I don't mean vacant of feeling, but it's not supposed to be sentimental, aimed like a heat-seeking missile to bypass the intellect on the way to the feelings. I've said that before. That's so important. The point is that though the apostle was a deeply passionate man, his style and teaching was not that of a sweaty, brow-mopping ranter who was in the habit of bypassing the intellect en route to the emotions. Some today could really take a lesson from him. He was passionate, but he was a thinking man's preacher. In fact, when our Lord Jesus Christ discoursed, the text often speaks of Jesus as sitting down and teaching. Not that sitting or standing is of the essence, understand, but teaching works its way down from the mind into the emotions. Any form of preaching that plays on the feelings alone and skirts the substance that belongs to the mind is no friend of the truth. It does not serve it well. Well, in the course of his public encounters in Athens, Paul wound up conversing with representatives of the two then leading and rival schools of philosophy in the empire. It says that some also of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Both ancient philosophies represented, and I'm quoting now, alternative attempts in pre-Christian paganism to come to terms with life, especially to come to terms with life in times of uncertainty and hardship. But as much as both schools of thought may differ, the Epicureans and the Stoic philosophers agreed in this. They agreed that the newfangled message brought by this Jew of Tarsus was not one that could appeal to reasonable men. I mean, how modern does that sound? I'm still quoting. They looked upon him as a retailer of second-hand scraps of philosophy, a type of itinerant peddler of religion, not unknown in the Athenian marketplace. This comes from Bruce. They used Athenian slang to represent his kind. He was a spermologos, a babbler, a seed picker, to dismiss him, an intellectual pretender, so to speak, who snapped up the ideas of others and peddled them as their own without understanding them. Others saw him as a merchandiser of divinities new to them. In the view of these two rival philosophical schools, we find touching points with religious perspective still very much alive in our generation. I want you to see that. Both schools of thought were philosophical approaches. They both sought to find answers for the way things are and to find answers for coping with life's ups and downs and unpredictable changes of fortunes. As some have noted, from then to now, secular sages have never improved upon their conclusions, and one will find echoes of these two philosophies rampant on the streets and in the halls of the academy to this day. The Stoics were essentially pantheistic, that is, everything was God. The Epicureans were functionally atheistic. They really didn't believe in the gods. A high percentage of people in the Western world, not to mention other parts of the world, fit into one of these two categories. The Stoics aim for living in harmony with nature. Hey, those of us who live in the Northwest, does that sound familiar? The Epicureans, however, were in the pursuit of happiness, which to them meant achieving a maximum of pleasure and a minimum of pain. The whole green movement, which has an Eastern pantheistic impetus, though not with every individual who espouses it, shares this ground with the Stoics, living in harmony with nature. They fail to realize in nature itself there's a dissonance that harks back to the fall of Adam and the curse in Genesis 3. The Stoics were fatalist. They didn't believe that God ruled. They thought impersonal fate ruled. What will be, you've heard it, still around today. The Epicureans, though, they were hedonists. They were just out to find happiness. The Stoic viewpoint is very rife street philosophy to this day. Everything has a purpose? Well, it does, but they're thinking more about fate. You hear it a lot in athletic circles. Epicurean philosophy reigns on college spring break. It reigns in fraternity and sorority houses and beer bashes and among baby boomers who only work to earn the right to play and to retire in the comforts of Palm Desert. Stoics saw history as circular. The Epicureans saw history as an endless movement of blind atoms. There's an element of truth to the Stoic view, but only an element. It's true that history is circular in the sense that history does have a way of repeating itself. How many times have you heard that? But it's untrue in the sense that history is purposeful, and it is headed linearly toward a climax, meeting a rendezvous with its creator. The Epicurean view reflected to some degree the philosophy of Darwinism, anticipated it. Life is a result of a combination of blind chance of purely material things operating by bond forces of nature. Do you see how all of this still resonates today? There's nothing new. Stoics are reflected in the modern pantheism of Eastern religions. All is one. Epicureans are naturalists who believe the world of nature is all the world there is. Stoics believed in recycling of life. There are Eastern ideas of reincarnation. They fit into the Stoic framework. Epicureans believed in simple dissolution. Epicureans fit into the atheistic and naturalist circle of thought and the death with dignity crowd. Stoics believed in engagement, that is, making the best of it. Epicureans believed in dropping out of the rat race and cocooning with friends. Modern existentialist and activist type would resonate. Do your study, make the best of it with a British stiff upper lip. People who take the view that we should eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die, well, they're Epicureans in spirit. You have only one life to live, so make the best of it and have fun before it ends. The have fun people are Epicureans to the core. It's all about family and friends, people are of the Epicurean spirit. So there you are, and that's what Paul was up against, and they want to know more about what it is that he's teaching. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.